countrywide on RTE Radio 1. Sponsored by Caller Gas, celebrating 80 years, bringing energy to Ireland's homes and businesses.
That is the unearthly sound of a wolf pack in the wild. And over the past few months, momentum has been growing for the idea of reintroducing the wolf to Ireland. Minister Josepha Madigan has rejected calls, though, for the reintroduction of the predator. But the conversation rumbles on. So what is going on and why now? Well, Padraig Fogarty from the Irish Wildlife Trust joins me on the line. Padraig, good morning to you.
Good morning, Damien.
Thanks for taking our call. Now, you, I know, have been highlighting the issue of rewilding, as it's called, and indeed this week the Green Party have been too. The reintroduction of the wolf is part of this bigger plan. What is rewilding and why do we need to look more closely at it now?
Well, rewilding in a nutshell really is about harnessing the power of nature to restore itself. In many ways, it's a recognition that we have in Ireland in particular more or less erased all of our natural ecosystems. So if we want to restore ecosystems, we really need to work with nature. And rewilding is about giving the space for nature to express itself. Now, in Ireland, a lot of that would be creating woodlands and native woodlands, which would spring up anyway.
Now, the last wolf was famously killed in Mount Leinster, I think, in 1786. How could the modern Ireland, the modern countryside we have become in the intervening 250 years, accommodate this animal? How could we go back in time, seriously?
Well, I think it's much more about going into the future and asking ourselves, you know, how are we going to live in a world that respects the fact that we are a part of nature and that nature has a right to exist? So up to now, you know, many of your listeners will know we have a major biodiversity and climate crisis. And much of that has been to do with the complete rupture within our relationship with nature. Basically, we've been at war with nature, which has led us to this awful situation at the moment where ecosystems around the world are collapsing. When you look at wolves in other parts of Europe, there are wolves, believe it or not, in Holland and Belgium and Denmark, places that would be, you know, just as civilized in a way as Ireland. So wolves don't need wilderness. And if we want to go into the future and try to restore some of the wild nature, I think this is what we need to be talking about.
But how would you go about actually reintroducing the wolves? What would the process be?
Well, I think the first process is that we have to have an honest conversation in Ireland about what has happened to nature. That has not happened so far. The government has committed to a citizens' assembly on biodiversity laws, which I think is an important first step. And I think if we are honest about what has happened, well, then the next step will be to, you know, what are we going to do about it? And actually, those solutions are at hand. And when we start having those conversations about, you know, bringing very large areas of native woodland back into play, then we're going to have to ask ourselves, well, how is that going to work? Because predators are a very important part of native ecosystems. And so the wolf will fit into that conversation, along, I should say, with over 100 other plants and animals that we've driven to extinction over the years.
But can you understand, we'll say, how farmers would be very sceptical about this, having predatory wolves roaming the countryside?
Well, I totally understand what has happened to farming over the years. If you look at places like Spain, for instance, where farmers are under the same pressure as they are here, and then they see wolves coming in where they hadn't been before. And naturally, farmers are thinking, oh my God, this is just another problem that we have to deal with. And in many of those countries, wolves are being blamed for the problems we have here, like low farm incomes and land abandonment. So this is part of the conversation that I think we need to have. Many countries in Europe are successfully living alongside large predators, and they're doing it with the help of the European Union.
Sure, but the only thing, Padraig, now, we can't be comparing Ireland and the Irish farming system with other European countries, because we're probably the only country in Europe that actually have cattle and sheep that graze mostly outdoors. In other countries, they're kept indoors, they're protected against predators like that. That's the difference.
Well, I think the key difference is that that animals are enclosed. They're not like places in rural Spain, in the north of Spain. A lot of the cattle are outdoors as well, just like in Ireland, and they're enclosed in fields. The problems arise when animals are kind of free roaming across hills. That's where the conflict arises. I mean, I totally appreciate there is a conflict in some of these areas, but the point is they are being resolved. And I think coexistence with nature and with these big predators is something that's possible.
All right, Suzanne Campbell is also here with us. Suzanne, you're listening to Pádraic there. Your thoughts?
I've been listening to this debate during the week, and actually it's funny because where farmers are looking for support to change their practices to more greener mechanisms and more less carbon and less impact on the environment and atmosphere, wolves is not one of those solutions. It's a complete red herring. I went to the Luberon in France to look at wolves a couple of years ago. It takes about a day to drive through the Luberon. We don't have a national park big enough to contain those predators. And also, I think it's really bounced against farmers who are thinking, you know, we're trying to sustain livestock on upland areas to try and farm with nature. But this is not an activity or a solution to what their needs are or what the needs are of rural communities at the moment.
Pádraic, fanciful thinking?
Well, I mean, one of the points there about national parks, I mean, this is part of the problem. We've kind of seen national parks as, you know, we're going to put nature into the national parks, and that's the place for nature to be. But, of course, in Ireland, our national parks are tiny. Frequently, they're full of farm animals, and there's not an awful lot of wildlife in them. So, really, we have to change our entire concept of nature. Now, talking about wilderness areas, you know, we don't need wilderness areas to have wolves. They're perfectly adaptable. And I'd like to say, I mean, rewilding is a very important part of the solution for addressing our biodiversity and climate crisis. Okay. But the other side of the coin is high nature value farming, and those two systems can work more or less in tandem with one another.
Right.
So definitely there's a future here for farming as well.
Absolutely, and as we said on this programme a couple of weeks ago, it's time that people from, I suppose, the environmental front like yourself, Pádraic, and farmers, instead of, I suppose, throwing brickbats at each other on Twitter and so on, actually got together, because you're going to have to work together in the future for all our betterment and including nature and indeed farmers' livelihoods, which are very important as well. Pádraic Fogarty of the Irish Wildlife Trust, as always, thank you very much for joining us. Now, last weekend saw 270 riders gather in Cavan for the National Dressage Championships, and the mood in the sport is buoyant in Ireland because we've just qualified a dressage team for the Olympic Games for the very first time. Four riders, all women, known as the Girls in Green. Now, dressage as an equestrian sport is not particularly strong in Ireland, but Suzanne Campbell, who is here and you've just heard from, went along to the Cavan Championships to find out more about dressage horses, their riders, and what Olympic qualification for Tokyo means. Suzanne, good morning to you again.
Good morning.
I'll give you an official welcome. Good news, tell us more.
Yeah, it's absolutely brilliant. In August, we qualified a team for the Olympics, Tokyo 2020, which will be next year, obviously, for the first time ever. So I went up to Cavan Equestrian Centre, fabulous place, to look at the national championship in dressage, to learn more about it and what kind of people take part in the sport. It's not something we're traditionally strong in. You'd see the Olympic medals dominated by the Germans, the Dutch and the British very recently as well, with two riders that have really brought a lot of attention to the sport, Charlotte Dujardin and Carl Hester, and they're on TV all the time and little girls love them. So the sport has got a lot more traction recently and a lot more participants. In fact, it's the fastest growing equestrian sport in Ireland, in all of the disciplines. And that's really interesting to hear. So what dressage involves is training horses to do very advanced level movements on the ground. They're not jumping fences. They're not galloping fast like our other equestrian sports. They're doing flat work. So if you think of Simone Biles, the Olympic athlete, she goes across the square and does tumbles and somersaults and it all looks amazing and beautifully easy. It took her probably 10 years to learn those movements and that repertoire. And it's the same with dressage horses. It takes about 10 to 15 years to teach them those movements. Mm-hmm. And where it came from was actually the military, as everything did with horses. It was for warfare, to turn very quickly your animal away from a lance that was coming at you, or to make them rear and actually go at someone who's attacking you. So you needed to have them really in control, being controlled, their front end and their hind end, and make them do stuff. So this evolved into a sport, and we tended not to be at the top of it because I think in Ireland we like going fast, we like jumping things, we have amazing national hunt jockeys, we have amazing eventers who have qualified for the Olympics, amazing show jumpers who we hope will qualify this Sunday. But then this all changed in our dressage pool with one rider, Judy Reynolds from Kildare, who's based in Germany. And now, in the past year, she's shot up the rankings. She's 12th in the world. She's competed as an Olympic individual. But then just recently in Rotterdam, with her teammates Anna Mervelt, Heike Holsten, both from Kildare, and Meads Kate Dwyer, they've qualified finally a first time for the Olympic Games. So three of these riders were in Cavan last week. I first met up with Heike and her lovely mare Sambuca, who's qualified for the Olympics. Now, as you'll hear in this clip, Heike had a bit of an accident just before she was about to ride in Rotterdam to get that qualifying score. And it just shows how much you need your team members around you when the pressure's really on.
So this is Sambuca. She is a big lady. She's nearly black. She has brown bits. She has two white socks behind.
What height is she?
She is about 17'1". She's the feminine version of Butch, whatever that is.
She's a really handsome head, doesn't she? She's a beautiful head, beautiful eye. Now, you bred her yourself and got her to this level. How rare is that?
I think it's quite rare. I don't know many people that have done that. Yeah, it's a long road, but it's worth it. I always knew she was very talented. She always felt amazing. She's very powerful.
Yeah.
And that's very important for Grand Prix. You need a lot of power.
Tell us about your background a little bit, because your mother was a very good dressage rider, so you were probably steeped in it right from the beginning, were you?
Yes, but I did Pony Club, Kildare Pony Club for years, hunter trialing for my school, show jumping. The only thing I didn't do was eventing because I was too scared, and always did dressage at the same time, but loved the dressage.
And you coach a lot of people and you're well known as a coach. Do you see it growing in popularity as a sport here?
Huge, like the Trailblazers classes are massive here, the national championships.
Which are children?
Children, yeah. They're under 12s and then there's an over 12 category, but the under 12s, massive. Good little jockeys and mad keen to do it. But also dressage is becoming people that show jump. Learning that the horses need to be more rideable and they need to be more athletic, and making your horse that it's obedient and it does what you want it to do, hopefully at the time you want it to happen.
What does it mean to you to be going forward with the team to Tokyo, and what did it feel like at the time?
Amazing. So I've had a bike accident an hour before. I was riding, my bike was coming back from the lorry park, which is 3.5 kilometres away, and the front, the brake locked on, and I went head over heels and landed on the handlebar into my stomach. I was in agony, and luckily I had 50 minutes till I was to get on the horse, and it was a real team effort. Like, everyone got the horse ready. My friend had to pull up my trousers and my socks. Judy did my hair.
You were really in agony then.
I couldn't move. Yeah. I couldn't move, and I couldn't do sitting trot in the warm up. And
oh my god!
And then it just all went numb when I went in. I couldn't ride for 2 weeks afterwards.
So you just got through it, like literally gritted your teeth.
Well, yeah, I wanted to ride. Like, there was nothing stopping me from getting on that horse. Even if I broke my head, I was going on.
And then getting through to Tokyo with that.
It was just amazing. And it was amazing to qualify. And I was so proud that I did it on her, you know, on a horse that I bred and produced myself. Extra special.
One big factor in Ireland's recent success, you know, you're hearing of the success and what's at the root of it. One of the big factors is coach Johan Hinnemann from Germany. And he's based in Germany. He's the coach to Judy Reynolds and Anna Mervelt. And both of these women, Anna's based abroad as well. What they do is they coach, they have students. And really, you can't earn money out of dressage. So you've got to be coaching and keeping students going all the time. And it's keeping the sport afloat with your students and with that income. And I asked Judy and Anna, Judy first here, what it means to the Irish team plans as a group to have qualified.
It's just huge, you know. It means we're secure for next year. Personally, it takes the pressure off, and we can plan what we want to do in terms of what works best for the horses and not be on that fight for a place for the rest of the year. So we can do what really suits us best.
What has made the change that a team is suddenly reaching that international level and we've got in the door now with an Irish team into the Olympics?
It's been a lot of planning, and it was a vision of the HSI to make this happen, and preparation. And I think we were quite lucky that the right horses and the right riders came together at the right time. But, you know, the difference it makes for us internationally is that we're now just taking that bit more seriously as a dressage country. You know, we're always seen as the show jumping and the eventing country. And, you know, we had individual good riders, Anna and Heike and myself. We've all ridden at Olympics and all been very successful individually, but we've never managed to do it at the same time. So, yeah, OK, Ireland as a country, as a team, is also to be taken seriously.
What did you feel personally when you knew the team had qualified for Tokyo?
I cried.
Oh, wow.
It was fantastic. We had four of us, the Green Girls. We get on magnificent. and it was such a buzz, and everybody was so thrilled. All the other nations were really, really, really thrilled for us as well. It was really an amazing experience.
And to be the first team to do it, it must have been really special.
Absolutely, especially as we've been in it for so long, and to get now to this stage that we actually have a team going to the Olympics is mind-boggling.
So they're known as the Girls in Green, hashtag Girls in Green. And to go back to Heike there, who we heard from earlier with Sambuca, it's really unusual, you know, to breed and train your own horse to Olympic level. And she was probably the only one at Rotterdam to actually do that. Most people either sell them at a very high level to someone else for millions or buy them if you're very rich enough. So there's an awful lot of untapped potential and money, basically, in well-bred dressage horses. It's also something we probably need to be doing here a bit more, because we have the riders and we have the skill set. So I asked Ronan Murphy of Horsesport Ireland, also who was also there at Cavan, what Olympic qualification means for the wider horse sector and for breeders here.
This is absolutely fantastic. It's groundbreaking. First time in the history of Ireland that we have a team qualified for the Tokyo Games in discipline of dressage. You know, it's a wonderful, inclusive sport. We have classes here at our national championships this week for children from 8 years of age right up to participants of 80 years of age. And the high performance end of that is our shop window. We have time and again proven in jumping that we have the best riders in the world. All over the world, Irish riders are sought after. And we have the best racing riders in the world and jockeys in the world. And it's no different for dressage, except the sport maybe hasn't had that profile internationally and at the high performance end that the other sports have enjoyed.
Can we produce the horses, though? Because traditionally we'd always think, well, they need to have a lot of continental blood and German blood. And if we bring that blood in here, is there no reason that we can do the same?
Heike's horse is a great example, a homebred mare. And, you know, we can do it. The breeding programme just needs to be defined. We need to get more people and breeders interested in breeding dressage horses, and specifically for dressage. We've been very good at breeding event horses. Our show jumping breeding, we just came back from the Young Championships in Lanarkshire last weekend, with 2 gold medals and 2 silver medals. Out of the 9 medals on offer, Ireland won 4. So our breeding programme is certainly working very well in those disciplines. It's an alternative enterprise. People could become involved in breeding dressage horses. And why not Ireland? We have the same climate, we have the same nutrition, the same expertise, our limestone soils. It's absolutely an ideal environment to breed horses, no matter what discipline they end up in the end.
That's Ronan Murphy of Horsesport Ireland speaking to Suzanne Campbell. Suzanne, as always, thank you very much. The recent beef protests were a raw expression of beef farmers' grievances about the price that they're getting for rearing cattle to produce beef of a very high quality for us, the consumer. For historian Professor Dermot Ferter, they echoed other protests from our recent past, and he joins me now in studio. Good morning, Dermot.
Good morning, Damien.
Let's go back to the most famous one. We've talked about it on the programme before, back to the famous Farmers' March and protest of 1966. Can you paint a picture of that time?
Well, that was a very interesting one, because it marks the culmination of resentments that had been bubbling for a long time. But it was also the drama of it and the physicality of it, because Rickard Deasy, as president of the National Farmers Association, led the farmers on a 217-mile march from Bantry all the way up to Dublin. It took 11 days, and then they sat for 22 days on the steps of the Department of Agriculture, because Charles Haughey, as minister, refused to meet them. So it captured the public imagination. Nothing like this had been seen before, but at the same time, Deasy was able to tap into that close connection Irish people had and still have, in many respects, to the idea of the land and the grievances that the farmers had.
They felt they weren't respected, wasn't that right?
They felt they weren't respected. What they were really looking for was, as they saw it, a fair share of national prosperity. This was the 1960s. Agricultural output had only increased by 1.5% by 1966. And they felt that they were being left behind, that they weren't getting their fair share, even though they were making their fair contribution. Now, what they got out of it ultimately was negotiating rights with the government. And they would have pointed to British farmers and say that British farmers are able to sit down annually and have an annual review with the British government and talk about policy and talk about prices. We need something like that. So they got that out of it. But it got very, very nasty. It didn't end with that sit-down protest. And there were imprisonments. There were farmers who refused to pay rates, and
they
there were goods seized.
And
they were blocking
the following year. Yeah.
So I mean, it got very, very nasty, and it was an illustration as well that the National Farmers Association, which was still in its infancy, it was only established in 1956, was going in a new militant direction. But we often forget Juan Green, who was the first president of the National Farmers Association. He was there before DC.
That's right.
DC had a particular charisma and a particular force. He was very distinctive with his blackthorn stick and his beret, and he was educated in Oxford, so he had a very unusual accent for an Irish farmer. But Juan Green before him, more understated, but was adamant that farmers needed to come together and stop this cannibalisation of the agricultural sector, because you had different organisations representing the different sectors, and the Irish Creamery Milk Suppliers Association were often at odds with the National Farmers Association. So, you know, Green really believed in the power of collective action, but that was difficult due to class differences and political differences, and, you know, the NFA was very much led by wealthier farmers.
Yeah, and the NFA was, of course, the pre-runner to what's now known as the IFA, the Irish Farmers Association. Let's go back and take a listen to some archive we've dug up from that time, around 66. The then Minister for Agriculture was Charlie Haughey, and he wouldn't meet the farmers until the protests were actually called off. Now, his government colleague and foe, you could say politically, George Colley, defended this decision in a clip from the RT archives.
Fire, we're off to Dublin in the green, where the helmets glisten in the sun, where the pain is...
Off to Dublin in the green, top of the Irish hit parade for a time, and of course, as you may remember, the chant taken up on the NFA march on Dublin in October. From all parts of Ireland, thousands of protesting farmers marched on the capital to present their case to the Minister of Agriculture and Fisheries. The refusal of Mr. Haughey to meet a delegation led to the famous sit-down on the department steps. It lasted night and day for 3 weeks. Meanwhile, the Minister for Industry and Commerce, Mr. Colley, was quick to defend Mr. Haughey.
Very many people in Ireland, including me, are full of admiration for the dignity and the courage shown by the Minister for Agriculture in dealing with the harassing campaign which has been carried on by the NFA against him. I also think that it should be quite clear to most people by now that what the NFA has been demanding and is demanding is that the government should surrender to it. No democratic government can do this, and if it were to do this, no decent people would go into public life, and eventually there would be no law and order, and it would be simply the law of the jungle.
Eventually, the farmers consented to end the Department of Agriculture sit-down and were met by the then Taoiseach, Mr. Lamass, and Mr. Haughey.
Of course, it was uppermost in our minds that the Taoiseach is retiring from office tomorrow. He referred to this himself, and as a result of these talks, Mr. Lamass gave us an assurance that he would propose to the new Taoiseach and the new Minister for Agriculture and Fisheries that they should meet the NFA at the very earliest opportunity for comprehensive discussions on all agricultural policies which the NFA wished to raise at that meeting.
And that was the voice of the late Rickard Deasy there. So the 60s, a very pivotal time in farmer-politician relations. Going back to the early days of the state, back to the 20s and the 30s, and specifically talking about beef farmers then, how were they looked upon? What sort of a class, where did they sit in the farmer class? Were you well off if you were a beef farmer back in the 20s and 30s, in the early part
of the
state?
Well, in the 1920s, the interesting thing, the infancy of the state, the first Minister for Agriculture in the Free State was Patrick Hogan, and he made a very unambiguous assertion. He said, national development is practically synonymous with agricultural development. Therefore, we have to do everything we can to help the beef farmers. Mm. Because he was thinking about how we're going to generate national income. You know, here's a state coming out of the Civil War trying to put the foundation blocks in place. And he was true to his word. And he wants to ensure that taxation policy and land policy wouldn't interfere with the free trade of beef farmers. And many of them did very well as a result. Now, it wasn't all plain sailing for them because Hogan did introduce new controls and regulations nations, because there was an issue about quality. Because during the First World War, there had been an agricultural boom. There was a huge demand for Irish beef and for Irish agricultural produce
generally.
Feed
the soldiers.
Yeah, feed the soldiers. But the competition wasn't there from the Danes and the Dutch. So Irish farmers did very well. But the priority was quantity rather than quality. So there are new quality regulations brought in. But then by the end of the 1920s, the Wall Street crash, free trade is being looked on in a very, very different way. And farmers are beginning to suffer. And then you have the transition from Cumhainvale to Fianna Fáil and the economic war from 1932 to 1938. That devastates many beef farmers. And what was at the core of that was the refusal by the government to pay land annuities. This was money owed to the British government as a result of historic land legislation that transferred land from the landlords to the tenants. And the British government responded by slapping a 20% duty on Irish cattle and other produce coming into Britain. And that was further increased to 30%. And we have an idea of what it meant in monetary terms, because between 1929 and 1934, the value of live exports dropped from 14 million to just 5 million.
Wow.
So you can appreciate that there were farmers that were devastated by that. And politically, of course, they're very angry, and they channel that into support in some cases to the blue shirts in the 1930s. There was a certain silver lining on that agricultural cloud, because in 1934, the government decided that families that were in receipt of unemployment assistance and home assistance would get free beef, £1.50 of beef a week. Right. And as a result, many poor urban-based kids were eating meat that they would not normally have had access to. So there was that interesting development. But there were distressing scenes of livestock being left to die in fields. And you can appreciate, even when we're listening to the 1960s tensions, a lot of those tensions actually stem from the 1920s and the 1930s. It was eventually settled in 1938. There had been, in the middle of it, a coal cattle pact because Ireland was refusing to buy British coal, and there was a bit of a trade-off. But it's not ended until 1938. And then you have, of course, a year later, the outbreak of the Second World War. And, you know, beef farmers hold their own. But what's coming after the Second World War are numerous reviews and inquiries into the state of Irish agriculture. And they're all highlighting the same thing. Irish agriculture isn't modernised. It's, you know, the land is overgrazed. The produce isn't marketed properly. You know, we need modern equipment that they couldn't import during the Second World War. And, you know, the 1950s is a bleak decade for Ireland economically. But the first half of the decade, you can actually see the genesis of the modern beef industry. Because there's a new emphasis on the idea of slaughtering and processing rather than exporting the cattle on the hoof. And by 1960, 40% of Irish cattle is being transported after slaughter. And you see the emergence of some of these beef processing factories as well. So there are certain improvements there, but by the end, it's not sustained into the late 1950s.
Okay, we're going to spool right on very briefly, Dermot. You talked there about our dependence on Britain, and our dependence on Britain continues when it comes to agriculture. Specifically beef. In 30 seconds, will there be a crash out on the 31st of October? What's your general gut feeling at this stage?
Oh, I think there will be a crash out, and there is the potential for chaos in the short term. But a lot of people taking the long view will look back to historic crises, look at the huge impacts that they had, but also ultimately the ability to adapt, but not without significant suffering.
All right. As always, it's a great pleasure to have you. Dermot Ferriter, Professor of Modern Irish History at UCD. And our thanks to Rob Canning in the RT Radio Archives as well. Dermot, thank you very much. Enjoy the rest of the weekend. Now, if you head out in Tinnicarrig Woods near Newbawn in County Wexford this autumn, you may find people wandering around with life-size model bears, owls and other animals. That's because Tinnicarrig Wood is home of Dunbrody Archers, a field archery club where members, young and old, can take part in competitions, but with an emphasis on simply getting out into the woods and having fun. Our reporter Daniel Clancy joined Secretary Clodagh Nolan as she pointed her bow and arrow at a lynx.
Tell us that, don't miss Clodagh.
So my bow is in my left hand. I'm pulling the string back with the right to my face, back up to my eyeline. Pulling back at the same time as pushing the bow.
Don't miss.
And then you aim for the target, decide where it is you're going, and you let go. Yay. And you hit it. Yay!
Score!
When you're doing field archery, you're out in the woods, you're out in the fresh air, you get to meet loads of different people, all different walks of life, all different ages, all different fitness levels, and you can be as competitive or uncompetitive as you like.
Shh. Won't miss Martin.
Martin doesn't like cycles, by the way.
He won't miss it, though.
Oh, look at that.
You have to have a sense of humour for that, too.
You were shooting at a lynx, but of course there's not too many live or real lynx left in Ireland at the moment anyway. But it's very realistic looking.
It's very realistic. They're life size. They're made of a particular type of resin. Obviously some of the animals that you'll see are not native to Ireland, but it's just to give us a selection of things to shoot at. I don't know if it's out today, but we do have a roadrunner. It's something else. So we'll move on now. As you can see, the arrow is directing you to the next target, so we just move on. And we're going to shoot at an owl.
So we're strolling through the woods now. The tree cover is coming down. We're kind of crisscrossing through branches here. There's leaves on the ground. It's a beautiful course as well.
We do have a couple of sighted deer here in the woods. So in of the morning of a shoot, there would a couple of us want to go one way and want to go the other way just to walk the course. That frightens them off away for the day. They stay away then. It's just to be on the safe side.
Absolutely. We do not shoot any animals, live animals, and anyone who does is out. Over just in the deeper part of the woods further on there, in May, it's like a bluebell garden. It's absolutely stunning when we come down and the whole floor of the wood is bluebells.
Yeah, shush.
Shh, shh. No pressure. Shh. Sorry, Mammy's shooting.
That's Mammy.
We call her Mammy. That's Helen. But she mammies all of us. She looks after all of us. So that's why we call her Mammy. She also gives out to all of us as well.
You have to keep them all in tow.
Did I misbehave sometimes here?
You have to rein them in every now and again. Give them some manners and respect. No, it's good.
Johan, are you going up for a shot?
My aunt is up.
So one of the younger members is up now.
That's Johan. He's been with the club about probably 3 years, Clara. Okay. Just a little high. Go again.
Oh, it's lovely, yeah. Everyone's kind of supporting and encouraging. And
archery is a family unity. Like, you get sons and daughters and fathers and married couples and all from all different backgrounds. Okay, well done. Well done.
This is the part where you check, Catherine, what...
where we hit him.
And if we hit him.
David and Una, ye are husband and wife team and sometimes competitors.
Always competitors.
And your arrows, we've walked up to the target here now, and your arrows are what, about 2 inches between each other?
Yeah.
Mine's closest.
More towards the inner kill rather than mine is more out. So, but nevertheless, they're both kills.
Yeah, whatever. Move on to the next target. We go in a bit deeper. Yeah, Riona can go first on the next target.
We're heading deeper into the woods now. And of all the sports, Laura, that you could have taken up, tell me how you got involved in archery.
Obviously, as you can see, Daniel, I'm very overweight. I used to go to a diet club that was based in the youth centre in Uras. While I'd be weighing in, my two children would be peeping in the window looking at the archers shooting in the hall, and eventually bullied me into finding out could they start archery, which I did. And 10 years later, my daughter drifts in and out. She does it sometimes and sometimes not. My son is gone, but I'm very much still here.
And had you been sporty before that, Claudia?
Back in the day, before I became very overweight, I played Gaelic football for 10 years. I played basketball, badminton. I tried squash, I tried tennis, I tried just about everything. I love sport in general. You know, other sports you have to stop at a certain age or a certain level of physical fitness. Archery, certainly. Certainly not. Look at Martin there, he's proud of that stomach look.
Oh, look at that, a kill.
That's 20 points. That's 20 points.
Do you want to have a go?
So has the time come?
Right, Daniel, I'll get Martin to show you. He's officially one of our coaches, so it might be better to let Martin show you.
Right, Daniel, come on.
So the target is staring right back up at us, Martin. So that is a giant bear.
Hopefully you will get him with the arrow. Keep us all safe.
So, Martin, you have the bow there in your left hand now.
In my left hand, and you will be pulling back the string with your right hand. So basically, you get you to stand here with your 2 feet like that.
So side onto the target.
Side onto the target. Your hip, your shoulder will be both facing the target.
Okay.
This arm will be coming up straight out to catch the bow.
Okay, so bow in left hand.
Left hand, okay. And you will draw right back up to your cheek.
So I could feel my arm wobbling there now.
Fire.
cracking the tree behind them.
Okay.
Timber!
So that flew there now. So we're about 25 metres away, and the bear had a lucky escape this time because my arrow went up into the tree above him. There's just a beautiful moment when you have it kind of leveled up, or at least you think you do. Does that kind of pause as you pull back? You can just hear the trees blowing. And
I put my arrow on and I pull back my bow. I don't hear the background noise. I just, as you said, I hear the wind, I hear the trees. You don't hear the talking in the background. You zone out onto your animal that you're shooting at, and everything else is forgotten. It's a peaceful, peaceful moment. In this world, you don't get many peaceful moments.
So it's a really nice sport that there's a silence in it and there's a calmness in it. So when you're shooting an arrow, that's all you're doing. It's just that kind of level of concentration. You just have to concentrate on those few tasks, so there's nothing else kind of gets in, which is what I really like about it.
Yeah, charge.
Okay, here we go.
Yeah! Yeah!
That was sharpshooter Daniel Clancy of Greyhound Media with Mary and other members of Dunbrody Archers in Tinnacarrig Woods near New Bawn in County Wexford. No live birds or animals were injured in the making of that report. Now, if you'd like to unleash your own inner Robin Hood or Katniss from the Hunger Games, there are a number of field archery clubs dotted right around the country. And that report was funded by the Broadcasting Authority of Ireland with the television licence fee. Now, vegan and animal rights groups have been very active in Ireland over the past number of years, with eye-catching billboard campaigns challenging our understanding of the way meat, eggs and milk are produced. The images are powerful. The slogans strike an emotional chord, like "Dairy takes babies from their mothers" or "She has one precious life, will your dinner take it?" Well, Aisling Meehan is a solicitor in County Clare who specialises in legal issues relating to farming, and she is a farmer herself. But she's just launched her very own billboard campaign to counter the arguments of the vegan lobby and put the farming point of view out there. And she's in our Limerick studio. Aisling, good morning to you.
Good morning, Damien.
The billboard campaign by vegan lobbyists, it's an example of really powerful advertising. But why have you decided now to answer back with your very own billboard campaign?
Yes, Damien. I suppose I'm dealing with farmers on a daily basis and also farming myself. The feedback that I would have got certainly would be that people would find these billboards, you know, anti-farming and offensive. Farmers have voiced concerns that children are ashamed to say that their parents are farmers. Certainly they've given examples of children being bullied and taunted about, you know, parents and, you know, using very derogatory terms which are linked to things, you know, such as artificially inseminated animals and animals sent for slaughter, etc. It was around that it kind of, I just felt that now is the time to you know, voice the concerns, fight back. Yeah, like, and I just want to be clear, I suppose it's not necessarily, it's not an attack on the vegan movement.
Sure.
I mean, I have friends that have pursued that as a lifestyle choice, and I absolutely respect their decision on that, and obviously everyone's entitled to their opinions. So, but what I want to do and what I'm aiming to do is that there will be billboards or promotional material put up which will promote agriculture and farming. Part of it, I suppose, is that it's going to tackle perceived negative aspects, such as, you know, the particular issues that you highlighted there around maybe, you know, milking practices or calves separated from cows and artificial insemination, etc. And it's basically trying to explain why farmers do things the way they do, as well, of course, as highlighting all that is positive in farming. And, you know, really it's defending and promoting our, I don't even like to use the word industry, it's a way of life. And
yeah.
it's for us to be proud of it.
Right. So what is the main message of your current, I mean, this is evolving, but just give us an example of what you're saying on the billboard for those that haven't seen any of them or the ads in the papers.
Of course. Yeah. So I suppose the first step of it was I wanted to garner the interest there amongst farmers and the rural communities to see, is it something, ideally what we're trying to achieve is that farmers will host billboards or promotional material on their own lands, because launching, we'll call it a counter campaign, was cited as the cost of doing that was cited as one of the reasons why it hasn't happened. So farmers, I suppose, are some of the biggest landowners in the country. So that they would host promotional material. And it's not necessarily, it's not my campaign. I want to be very clear in this.
Yeah.
All I'm trying to do is get the thing started. But essentially, it's going to be a campaign run by farmers, for farmers. And actually, where we're at the moment, Damien, and it is, I've set up a page on my website. So if you Google Understand Agriculture, that's what the name of the campaign is. And I'd love for people to register their interest in, you know, hosting these promotional materials. So I've got a group of farmers together. They're some of what I would consider some of the best communicators that are there in agriculture. And that basically these will be ambassadors for
right.
Us farmers. And so the idea is that we will form a co-op. I've put together an application for funding to the Golden Jubilee Trust, which is being considered at the moment. And the idea is that we would fund the cost of putting up these promotional materials, be they billboards, etc., and that the farmers then will allow these to be put up on their fields. So that's kind of what I would like to achieve. And then who knows, please God, if it takes off, that we can see these billboards in towns and cities and
yeah.
and all over. And it's not, as I said, an anti-vegan movement. What it is it's just speaking up for agriculture and explaining why we do things the way we do. And it's a positive campaign.
And just to go back to my question, though, what message have you on the billboards? What
Sorry,
is it they're saying?
Yeah. Yes. So I just put out, we call it a test poster, and it's something we'll say you have our poster that you alluded to there where it says dairy takes babies from their mothers. So the poster that I had created following feedback from farmers and also working with a designer, we have a picture of a dairy calf and it says my mom is a working mom, and then I have a picture of a suckler calf and it says my mom is a stay-at-home mom.
Okay.
So again, I just wanted to depict
it's kind of
picture.
Eye-catching. Yeah,
it is eye-catching.
Yeah.
And it is to show, I suppose, that there's more than dairy cows there. There's different systems of farming, and it's just to highlight
right.
that and to give the facts around it.
All right, Ashley. Well, listen, it sounds like a very interesting initiative. It's your own idea, and it's Understand Agriculture. If people Google that, they can find out a little bit more about it. So thank you very much indeed for joining us and coming into our Limerick studio there this morning. That's Ashley Meehan, agricultural solicitor based in County Clare.